Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Sunday edition. Today's date is the 16th day of August, 2009. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you all here with me for another important broadcast, another important discussion of world events and problems that we as a race of creatures on this planet, human beings, are facing, an evil that we're facing, a criminal network of psychopaths that have little regard for the rest of us not involved in their crimes. And sadly, ladies and gentlemen, it seems to me they are really pulling out all the stops in a lead-up to September to really force us all into a terrible situation. And one of them I'm going to be bringing up my guest in a moment to talk about is this flu virus thing. And I fear, frankly, that the vaccine is far more deadly than any possible flu outbreak. And they're going to test this flu vaccine with squalene in it on children, on school children, and it's just been reported in the press. Heartbreaking stuff. It makes me angry. Makes me want to work harder. And I believe my guest will echo those same sentiments. His name is Adrian Salabucci, and he is, of course, a world patriot and an Argentine citizen, and has been investigating many of the same conspiracies I have from a slightly different perspective, but his research has just gone, it serves to verify the work that I've put on the French Connections website. You can find Adrian's work at the www.asalbucci, A-Salbucci, and that's spelled SALBUCHI.com.AR. And we will have a link to that somewhere on my site after the broadcast so that you can go to Adrian's site. There's a YouTube video also up on my front page that Adrian has just recently done. There's a second part to that, so you can expect me to be posting that shortly. And so without any further introduction, I'm going to bring up my guest. Adrian, are you with me?
Yes, absolutely. Good afternoon. Nice to say hello to you again,
Dan. It's wonderful, Adrian. You know, I you just told me it's getting chilly over there. You're in the middle of your winter, and the Southern Hemisphere is experiencing cold temperatures, and I'm sitting in my loft here with temperatures approaching 40 degrees Celsius or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and I'm absolutely melting. So if you hear noise in the background of this broadcast, it is a fan blowing directly on me so I can sit here and do this. Were I not to blow this fan on me, I fear I would melt into a puddle. But anyway, that being said, you know, so much is going on. I just watched your most recent video, and the first part of it, of course, is a call to arms, really, for people of like minds to begin to really focus on these criminals. And one of the things that has separated you from many of the other people who claim to be truth tellers is you've been willing to actually identify the names and places and people involved in the crimes, as opposed to using amorphous, rather nondescript accusations against. Well, when you say the New World Order, and you do use that, you make sure that people understand that New World Order is made up of primarily, at the top, primarily a Zionist adherents, or Zionist Jews in many instances. And most people who use that term never add that it's a Zionist conspiracy. They always say the New World Order, but they don't say who's behind it. And so you should be congratulated, Adrian, and I want to give you a chance to just address that first point.
Well, yeah, absolutely. As you were just saying, if we're going to talk about the New World Order, we might as well start by identifying exactly who we are talking about, who these people are. Think of it. If you're going to fight an enemy and you don't properly identify that enemy, well, then you're not going to be able to tell your army which way to go, which way to attack, and how to identify the good guys from the bad guys. Not that I'm going to be so Manichaean to say we are the good guys, they are the bad guys. The truth of the matter is that this is a vast political battle. We definitely have one set of values which reflect the psychological makeup of, I would say, yourself, myself, the people who are hearing you right now, most people who earn a living, who study, who raise a family, who do productive things in a productive way for their neighborhoods, for their for their countries or for their families. And on the other side, with the people we are fighting, the New World Order, I call it a corporate think tank organizational network, very closely knit, very powerful. You start seeing, when you start analyzing them, that they can be identified, although they are discreet, because they very often do not show themselves out in the open. They are not really secret, and even if they try to be secret, a little bit of shrewdness will easily show where they are and what they are up to, and naturally they are organized very much on a pyramid-like basis, and at the top of the pyramid, you do have the various organizations that in one way or another, either politically, or economically, or geopolitically, or even Masonically, support the Zionist ideal, which is far more than merely supporting the state of Israel, because you have to see how Zionism evolved over the past century, century and a half, and from being a very secular movement that merely wanted something that sounded so meek and so understandable, a place under the sun for the Jewish people who were being persecuted, especially in Europe, has turned into a very totally different beast, whereby they not only have obtained that place in the sun for themselves through violence and by eradicating the original population there, I'm talking about Palestine, mm-hmm. They have gone so far as to be able to actually control, I would even say fully control, the world's major superpower, which is the United States of America.
Well, and you know, interesting to note, even in advance of Zionism, this group used mayhem and deception to ensconce themselves in power in the United States back, all the way to the founding of the country, but through their slave trade and the rest. But I'm going to bring up a little subject here that's interesting, and most people don't realize it. We learn in the American history books that after the Civil War, groups of what they called carpetbaggers descended on the South to mop up all the assets that had been dislodged from the elites that ran the South. And these elites that ran the South, by and large, were Protestant elites from Western European nations. However, once those assets had been put in play, Zionist Jews from the North came down into the South and took all of those assets and coveted them and took them for themselves. And most people don't make the connection, because in our history books, Adrian, they always talk about carpetbaggers, but they fail to mention that the predominant group, or almost the entire group, were Jews. And you'll find these same people who did this back in the Civil War times still living in those cities, in Memphis and in New Orleans and in Atlanta, Georgia, and they're running the show down there. They are just running it, and they took it over after the Civil War. So basically, when people learn in their history books, is often just a partial story. Am I right?
Yes, I was brought up in America, and I do remember the episode on the carpetbaggers. I didn't know, this is something new to me, and it's very interesting what you're saying. To just give you a parallel, because the United States is in the northern part of the American continent, Argentina's way in the other side. In the 19th century, we had a, I won't say similar movement, but something that is a bit of a parallel, although much more open, when Theodore Herzl begins his Zionist movement, there is a chapter in his book where he goes so far as to say that if we can't get Palestine, we should get Argentine. He actually says that there's a paragraph that is called Palestine or Argentine, and it's got a question mark at the end. And he proposes the first option, if Palestine was not available or could not be seized, that parts of Argentina should be seized. And he specifically said that Argentina would have the greatest interest in ceding a part of our territory against a financial compensation, because Argentina is a very, very vast country, low population, large territory, immense wealth, natural wealth I'm speaking of here, and there was a friend of Baron Rothschild, a guy by the name, who lived in Paris, actually by the name of Maurice Hirsch.
Yes, yes.
A very rich businessman.
Yes.
And he began financing the transportation of Jews from Romania, Russia and other parts of Central Europe, mostly, even some parts of Germany, into Argentina. But luckily, they settled in very specific areas, in the city of Buenos Aires, in one of the provinces here called Entre Ríos, which means between rivers, like Mesopotamia, because it's between two large rivers, and in certain specific parts of the province of Buenos Aires. And I must admit, they settled down rather peacefully at that time, but their local organizations, they have two organizations here, very powerful ones, called the AMIA, A-M-I-A. They are the ones who had their head office blasted by a terrorist attack in July.
A Jewish-inspired terrorist attack.
They did it. No,
yes, but it was definitely Jewish-inspired.
The DAIA, D-A-I-A, which is a more political thing, they are always ensuring that the local Jews do not integrate, that they do not assimilate into the local population, because if there's one thing about Argentina that I have to point out, it assimilates people very, very quickly, because it's far away, it's a vast country. We are mostly of Italian and Spanish stock, so it tends to become a very, family-like atmosphere, throughout, especially in the interior part of the country.
Big Sunday dinners over there,
exactly.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and people intermarry here a lot. My own wife is of, I'm obviously of Italian stock with a name like Salbucci, but my wife is of Hungarian and Spanish and part German stock, so you can see we're all one true enormous mixture. And a lot of Jews here have intermarried with Gentiles, especially the men, and their own organizations are permanently reminding them, hey, don't forget we're different. Hey, don't forget we were persecuted during the Holocaust. Hey, don't forget they blew up our embassy and then they blew up our social institution. And they're always inventing out of thin air that they are being persecuted just as a way of keeping their own people together and not letting them, you know, go, oh, we like sheep have gone astray, otherwise it's for them.
Well, you know, the asset seizure of country after country of this group astonishes people when they finally turn their attention to the facts. One thing that I've always noticed, Adrian, is that most people believe that Jews living in the United States are, I'll give you an example. I brought up some of these facts with my neighbor. Now, she's not up on many of the details of history, but when I said to her what percentage of Jews live in the United States, what percentage of American population, she said 20, 25. And I said, what makes you believe that 20 or 25% of America is Jewish? She said, well, most of your representations in sitcoms and television shows and businesses and finance and news people are mostly always Jewish. So most people believe that America is, you know, must have 20, 25% Jewish. I said, if I were to tell you they were only 2%, would that surprise you? She said it would floor me. And I said, well, it's a little over 2%. That's the official figure. It might be a little bigger than that. It might be 2.5% or even 3%. But the fact is they run 70% of the media in outside of Hollywood. They own 100% of the Hollywood media. They run the drug companies. They run the finance industry. They run the banks. They run all of the major industries in the United States. And they're only 2.5% at a maximum. This is an astonishing fact. And when you finally learn that 7 out of 10 world billionaires are Jewish, and they represent less than 0.1% of the world's population, it becomes even more frightening.
Well, you see, that is probably one of the key points that I think it's up to you guys like you and me and those who are listening to really start putting through to the world. As you say, in America, it's 2 to 2.5% of the population, and yet they are overrepresented to the extreme, depending on the circle, on the sector. In Hollywood, they're like almost 100%. In finance, they have a very high representation. In the media, they have an enormous representation. Look at your newspapers like the New York Times, the New York Post, the L.A. Times.
The Trib, yes.
The Trib, I mean, the people who are actually analyzing reality and giving opinions, they have a huge overrepresentation of Jewish folk. In Argentina, we have a pretty similar situation. We are about 40 million people, and according to their own figures, they say they are about 200,000, which comes out to a ridiculously low figure of about, 0.5% of the population. Now, when you look at Argentina's media, when you look at our TV programs, when you look at our sitcoms here too, the banking system and major corporations, you'd say, now, hang on a minute, there's something wrong here. They are overrepresented. But there's a second part to all of this. Because, you see, if the figures are right, and anybody can check them by looking at the official Israeli website or the Jewish Virtual Library from the United States, which also puts out these figures, and a myriad of other Jewish and Zionist organizations that actually give population figures, you figure if all these figures are correct, and they all say basically that there's about 16 million Jewish people in the whole world, that's 0.2% of the population, that means that 99.8% of the population of planet Earth is not Jewish. If those figures are correct, then what you can say is that we have a terrible case of overrepresentation, which is basically extremely undemocratic. I mean, we have an extremely undemocratic system in America, in Europe, in Argentina, whereby a part of the population is grossly overrepresented. Now, the second part of the story, Daryl, I think, is, are those figures correct? Because I can hardly believe that an ethnic group so well organized and so wealthy as the Jewish community the world over are unable to produce exact figures of how many are their lot. You know, some of them say 15.4 million, others will say 14.4 million.
I put up a story on my website recently where a researcher said there were 13.5 million. And when you do the numbers of 13.5 million into 6.5 billion people, you come out with 0.003%. So these people aren't even 1% of the world's population.
Oh yeah, as I was saying, 99.8% of us, 99.8% are non-Jews.
That's
now,
right.
The point I want to make is that there's something very wrong here, because if you walk down the streets of Argentina, you will literally see that there are a lot of them. In other words, 200,000 is just too low a figure for the whole country. Now, what I suspect is that they are they're fiddling around with the figures, because of probably if we were to have the exact figures with Israel, New York City, Argentina, and all the major packets where they are located, you probably have a figure closer to 35, maybe 40 million, which makes much more sense. However, if they were to admit that there are 40 million or 35 million Jews in the whole world, then the next question is, how do you work out the arithmetic of the 6 million in the Holocaust?
And that's a very important question, and you know what, it leads me to my next caveat here. Sadly, Adrian, they have been successful at silencing any investigation into any of the subject matter pertaining to that particular event by virtue of the fact that I would be clearly threatened with a jailing and a criminal investigation where I live in Central France, because the Central French region that I'm in has already prosecuted two people for what they consider a Holocaust denial. So I am forced by law to avoid even investigating those facts, which is a painful fact for me to face, because the French are, at least on paper, are so proud of having freedom of expression and freedom of this and freedom of that, when in fact none of those things are true here in France. You've got freedom as long as you stay out of certain subjects. You've got freedom, to talk to your neighbor, but don't say anything about your belief system or the things that you believe. For example, if I were to talk about finding the whole practice of homosexuality to be sacrilegious, here in France, I can be prosecuted for hatred. And so this is a terrible state of affairs especially for me, coming from a place where I once believed I had the right to speak freely, but that those rights have been destroyed in this last wave of control these people have placed upon the planet.
Yeah, something similar is about to happen in Argentina. However, they are delaying it because the way our history has been, and because we've gone through a lot of revolution and social turmoil, and we've had a lot of persecution. For example, when we had our the various military regimes, there was extreme intellectual persecution there, and that has made a lot of people very sensitive to anybody saying you cannot read this. We're going to make a book burning exercise and this and that. So although there is a lot of talk about trying to put one of the a similar law of that sense in what they call hate writing and Holocaust denial, we still do not have an actual law in place. And I have my doubts whether they will actually be able to do so, because probably the better part of the population would definitely not agree to it. I think that perhaps the best thing to do, and I'm very much aware of the fact that that you're there in France, so you probably feel much more uncomfortable for very obvious and unjust reasons than I do from here in Argentina. The important thing is to just start putting everything in proper perspective, people themselves will realize that there is something terribly wrong. As I say, why are population figures being forged? Why are they being changed? Why are they being kept artificially low? What is the reason that makes such a powerful community decide to bring down their population figures to ridiculously low levels? As I say, they say there are only 200,000 in Argentina, and anybody here can realize that it's probably 10 times that figure as far as Argentina is concerned. What reason can America have to say that instead of being 300 million, you're 200 million? Or what reason could Argentina have to say instead of 40 million, we're just 30 million? People don't do things just because they feel like it. People do things normally for good reasons. I'm sure they have a very good reason. If they were to publicize the exact figures, somebody, even from their own lot, would say, now hold on a minute, if we are 35 million today, and we were, I don't know, 15 million in 1939, according to the Jewish almanac, can somebody please tell me how our population evolved through all these years, through the terrible years of World War II and afterwards?
Well, these are certainly important questions for other researchers. Now, what I have concentrated on, and you've been a visitor to my site on many occasions, is I try to bring historic documentation of crime and of a geopolitical manipulation through many authors, many great authors on my site, and bring people a step-by-step process into the present. And of course, you know, the Herzl idea of Zionism is nothing but a modernized incantation, if you will, of the exact conspiracies that have followed mankind for centuries, if not millennia. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a group that you may have heard about, and I'm wondering if they're actually setting up shop in your area, called Common Purpose. And at the top of Common Purpose is a woman named Julia Middleton, who is a Zionist, a communist Jew living in London, who she actually has very close ties to Tavistock, and she miraculously came up with a huge amount of money to launch this Common Purpose program. What they do is they recruit leadership from bureaucracies around the Western world and indoctrinate them as a extra-governmental organization. And does it sound eerily similar to some of the operations of Freemasonry?
Absolutely, and you see, I think that is merely just one more head of the Hydra, which shows that it is a system of work. In other words, we have here to understand that as Westerners, yourself, well, you're from America and you're in France right now, and I'm here in Argentina, we have come to be made to believe that a war is usually two sides, and one side openly saying, I'm going to kill you, and the other side openly saying, well, I'm going to kill you, and then they bomb each other and they kill each other. And if anything, I would say that as far as, for example, the Jewish community is concerned, their only truly open war is the one that they are presently holding in Palestine. In other words, you have the Israelis on the one side and then the Palestinians on the other side, and the Israelis bombing the Palestinians.
Well, that's a genocide in my view, but yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at least you could even publish in the newspapers there are obviously two sides to this combat. However, in what you're mentioning, in the social battle that they wield in America or in Europe or in Argentina, usually what they do is they infiltrate, and you have it as you would have a virus. In other words, it's like when you're ill. If you're ill because you have a terrible infection in your arm, you'd say, well, I'm feeling very feverish, I'm feeling very bad because I've got this horrendous infection in my arm. But if a virus attacks you, you are being attacked through the whole body politic, and you don't quite know exactly what it is, and you can't even see your enemy. So I think in this case, we have to be very much aware that the tactics and the strategies that they use are such that it can be compared in a way to disease. It can be compared to a virus. In other words, you are being invaded. You are being made to feel very badly in your social body, and you don't quite know where the origin.
Well, that is the you're right, and that is the root of their success. And many of these modern expressions of Zionism have come out of what you mentioned in your video, think tanks. And I have to mention one that is very active and has, as I mentioned it with Julia Middleton, which is, of course, Tavistock, but we have a sister organization in America out in the West Coast called the Stanford Research Institute. And these groups, they spend large sums of money learning how human beings are best manipulated, whether it be through suggestion in media or through false reporting or so many ways. And of course, they are the best in the world at deception, and they've wielded this power with accuracy throughout the world to buffalo people into thinking that that everybody but them is the blame.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we have to be very alert about, because let's not forget that although the top of the pyramid, as we've been saying all along this program, has a lot to do and is intimately linked into the Zionist organizations, let's be very open about this in the sense that there are a lot of Gentiles who are acting precisely
yes.
like Zionists. The Vice President of the United States and the President of the United States, for example, not just the present one, but the previous one. So that being said, I think that we have to understand I think that in these think tanks, when they work together, they have really prepared a very intelligent, in the sense of a very complete and thorough war plan. I mean, we have to speak about a war plan, because they know that, for example, they are micromanaging different processes that go forward at different speeds. Let me explain that.
Yep.
If you look at finance moves second by second. I mean, things like they can go up, down, sideways, forwards. You can put investments through to the other side of the world in just minutes' time. The economy, which is our next subject, for example, that goes much slower. The economy can evolve, but it evolves in weeks and months and even sometimes in years as technology goes into the various processes and so forth. Politics, which is the way the political evolution, for example, of a country like the United States has been going, you can see the erosion, but you have to actually take a much faster vista. You can see throughout 5, 6, maybe 10 years. And psychology, the human psychology, that normally takes generations. So they know that what they have achieved, and I think that they have done it with Machiavellian brilliance, they have achieved for people today to accept what they would have no way accepted a generation ago. Even accepting things exactly the opposite. I was brought up in America in the 1960s, and I remember governors from states like Alabama, George Wallace, I'm thinking specifically, Mississippi,
yep.
Louisiana,
yep.
Barring black people from even going into a university. There were no dogs or blacks allowed in certain parts. I've seen that myself. I'm old enough for that. And you figure, look the way they've completely turned around, for the good in this instance, how they turn around the mentality of the American
people. But, you know, they used that event to polarize. You see, the benefit that came out of it for the African-American community certainly benefited them in real terms. However, the process was not a win-win for both communities. What they actually succeeded in doing is breaking down the communications between blacks and whites and trying to make a permanent enemy out of these two communities, rather than looking at these communities as partners in a nation's future. They set them up through secularizing and through you want to call yourself before you call yourself an American anymore, you call yourself a Korean American or a Black American, an African American, or you call yourself a what they've done here is through very elaborate schemes broken our cohesion as a unit, as a country. They did the same with the family, destroying it through battling men against women and generational battles between fathers and sons. And the simple truth of the matter is they're master manipulators, and the thing they fear most, Adrian, is that we begin to come together as families and as citizens and as communities, because once we can put aside the manipulations they have fostered, we'll be able to see together what needs to be done. And right now, that's still a battle that's raging. We're not able to work together.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the tragedies of America, and probably it bears the seeds of your future, I hate to say this, but your future splitting up into maybe two, maybe three, maybe four countries. I don't think there is a country in the world where people will identify themselves as you just said a few minutes ago, well, I'm Korean-American, or I'm Japanese-American, or I'm Afro-American, or Hispanic-American. As I was saying before, Argentina, which is also a melting pot of immigrants, I would never even dream of calling myself, I'm Italian-Argentinian, and my wife is Hungarian-Argentinian. It's so ridiculous, because people here are absolutely just plain Argentinians. Now, if you happen to be of Spanish, English, German, Swedish, Italian stock, that's totally something like you would discuss with friends, or which just becomes obvious from your own last name. If anything, it is very often the Jew who will put himself apart, who will set himself apart, and he will put that rather persecution-like tone in his attitude towards his other countrymen. But even that here is really to a much lesser degree. However, in America and in the United States, I think that is tragic, because you start to realize that being an American in a way has become a sort of a fictitious elaboration, because the only way you have been able to pull together after all these divisions of pull together your different people, the different people have immigrated from different parts of the world, is by creating one myth. In other words, your whole idea of America is too much based on mythical symbols. In other words, the Pledge of Allegiance, the flag, which Hollywood is always showing very, very exceedingly and openly in its movies, trying to say, well, you better believe in these symbols, you better hang on to them, because if we don't have these symbols, America will just split up into a million pieces. Whilst Argentinians, for example, just to give you the other case that at least I know about, since we are also a young country, basically people figure, well, I was born here, I'm part of this, this is where I am, and it's just fine the way it is. I don't need anybody to shove the Argentinian flag down my throat, if anything, at all. It just came about very much more naturally. I won't compare this with Europe, because you're in France right now, and France being a very an older country, you have literally thousands of years that they could look back proud on. But in America, where all countries are very young, the only country that I find that still bears the seeds of its disruption and fracture is America, and it goes way down to the population, where a Korean American still feels Korean, a Black American knows damn well that he's Black, and in spite of all the civil rights and so forth, Blacks are still segregated, because economically they are still much worse off. So we still have segregation on a much more hypocritical basis.
Well, that's all of those points are well taken, but you know, even though America seems to, the United States of America, which frankly was birthed and born out of theft and murder, you know, you can't ignore the fact that that there were millions of indigenous Americans living in the continent. They didn't call it America. They called it the Great Spirit, Father Spirit of the land. And the land was for all the people who lived on the continent to share and to prosper in. Of course, when we brought our European groups over, and they were spearheaded economically by Jews, and you can see the Murano migration, and you can see the New York elites growing out of the first arrivals, all the way back to 1670 and 80 in Newport, Rhode Island, when people such as Aaron Lopez were bringing slaves in. But my point being is that the whole entire experiment of the United States, from its beginnings, were based upon theft. Now, we see a theft very similar to that going on in Palestine, and there were actual comments made by some Zionist Israelis that said, well, you know, we have a right to kick these Palestinians out. Well, the Americans built their country by kicking out a minority. And this is an actual recent statement in the press. Now, this is. I mean, they're saying, you know, I can murder these people because you guys did it. And can you imagine that kind of thinking goes on in people? But when you understand the origins of their thinking, being Talmudic, These people don't think like we do. There is a psychopathic thinking mechanism going on in the way they see the world.
But you know what? The best way, I fully agree with you on that. The best way to fight that, I think, is to just bring enormous doses of common sense. Let me give you one small example, because you just touched upon a very terrible subject, which is the fact that what happens when one group of people feel that they are superior to another and that they have a God-given right to kick people out of their territory, to kill them, to take them as slaves, and so forth. We see it today with the Israelis in Palestine, and we've seen it in the past with the slave trade, where people, just because they were black and were born in Africa and did not have the type of civilization that Europeans or Americans had, that was a God-given right for them to just pick them up and throw them in as slaves in Brazil, in America, and even in Argentina at the very beginning, 3 or 4 centuries back. And that has a lot to do with, what do you do when somebody feels that they are different or
better than, yes.
Right. Which in this day and age should be very easy to brush aside if you use basic common sense. Now, let me just give you one very quick example. When we talk about anti-Semitism, we see that, the basic rationale is that the Jewish community in different ways has been persecuted since many thousands of years ago. And they've been expelled from Chaldea, and they've been expelled from Babylon, and they were expelled by the Egyptians, and then they were expelled by the Romans. And then they were expelled from Spain in 1492 or 93, and from Portugal. And in 1289, the English also expelled.
And they were thrown out of England on more than one occasion, and France 3 times, and they were kicked out of Venice. But think about it. Why were they kicked out all those times?
Let me just go on to
that. Yep.
You have in France the Captain Dreyfus case. You have, well, Germany, perhaps in modern times, has been the country that has been particularly hard with the Jewish community. And you had before that, pogrom is a Russian word, so that they were very badly treated in Russia. And you have the same in Romania, and there's been anti-Semitism in Argentina and in America. And you figure, well, hold on a minute. If I go through vast millennia of time from 4 or 5,000 years ago until today, and if I go through the vast geography of the planet from Babylon all the way to Argentina and to California, is it that all of humanity throughout space and time has a psychic pathology which we call anti-Semitism, of which the Jewish people are the innocent victims of, or the other way around? Is there something in the Jewish behavior, social behavior, that makes it automatic that they will always run into trouble and be rejected by the host country where they live? So if you're going to be irrational, you're going to say, no, all of humanity is dead crazy, and just a small, tiny group are really nice people because they are the ones that are always being persecuted, or you figure maybe this small group of people has such behavior that they will always end up triggering the same rejection and repulsion from all the host countries where they go, because the way they behave just leads to that, and period.
Well, and you're, that is a perfect point to make in regards to the mentality, Adrian, and I must say that early on in these machinations by the Jewish community, when they were being expelled from Babylon and even Spain, they were of Semitic origin. They were Los Moros, and they had Moorish, North African and Middle Eastern roots to their community. But today, of course, extensive research has been done that many of these people aren't even Semitic. And so here again we have their skills as deceivers, and then their armies of lackeys to propagate the story. And interesting to note that many of the stories that are pushed out into the collective belief systems in our world are put out there by non-Jews, because they work within a structure that forces their thinking to go down certain paths that are erroneous. So you're exactly right. You don't have repeated ejections of a group just based on their differences. I mean, if that were true, then we would have kicked out all the Mongolians in America, or we'd have kicked out all of the Koreans, and or we'd have how much more different can you look than a workaday American than being Korean? I mean, but see, the Korean community didn't arrive in America and begin to usurp the rights of the people around them. You see.
Sorry, but you got cut off for about 15 seconds there.
Well, the